Welcome to Inspiration Loves Company, a podcast about doing better and being better at life, work, and everything in between. I'm your host, Debbie Epstein-Henry, a lawyer turned entrepreneur, public speaker, and author. I'm so glad you're here. Our guest today is Jonathan Greenblatt. Jonathan is the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. Since joining in 2015, Jonathan has modernized the ADL while refocusing its mission to fight the defamation of the Jewish people and to secure justice and fair treatment to all. In 2022, Jonathan released It Could Happen Here, a book that sounds an alarm, warning that hate and systemic violence is gathering momentum in the United States, and that violence on a more catastrophic scale could be just around the corner. Welcome, Jonathan. So great to be with you. Big thank you to Carol Goldstein for putting us together. How are you?
Great. Nice to be here.
Terrific. So I want to start with how and why you became CEO of the Anti-Defamation League and what your focus has really been since leading the organization.
Sure. So by way of background, I spent most of my career in business, starting and scaling and selling companies like high impact startups. I was early at a little company called Realtor.com that went public, got very large. I co-founded a business with my roommate, my MBA roommate, called Ethos Water that we scaled and sold to Starbucks, and I worked there for a while. I was at a little company called Good that spun out a venture that Google invested in called All for Good that got big. We raised a lot of money and then that got acquired. So I had a few of those kinds of exits. And then those were bookended between stints in government. I did international economics in the Clinton White House, and then I ran the Office of Innovation in the Obama West Wing. So I have been in business kind of building innovative companies. I've worked in government trying to drive policy to create jobs. When this came up, you know, I was approached by a headhunter, and to be honest, you know, Debbie, I didn't think this was a good fit. And I'm an MBA by training, not a lawyer. This is a venerated civil rights organization. I am certainly Jewish, but I never worked in the Jewish community. And, you know, I had no nonprofit experience. So it was an out of the box idea, I think, for them to reach out to me. But the one thing I do know is that I care deeply about anti-Semitism and hate. My grandfather was a Holocaust survivor from Germany. My wife escaped Iran as a political refugee, also Jewish. And so for me, these issues are not just issues of professional interest. They're deeply personal. Right. And so when I had the opportunity to bring what I know about building brands, leading teams, shipping product, you know, generating policy to this organization, I thought it was an interesting opportunity to make an impact on the issues I cared about. And flash forward, it's been seven and a half years. I mean, we have been operating at a breakneck pace because the issues of anti-Semitism and intolerance generally, but specifically anti-Semitism, have expanded, they've intensified. And I think we're operating in an environment today that's far more complex than the one that I inherited 7 years ago.
I didn't know that you didn't have the nonprofit experience. It's so interesting that you were approached by a headhunter and they saw that you had the breadth of experience in all these other arenas and that you could bring a lot to this position, which of course you have. And I think I want to get a little bit more into your background because I read your book and congratulations, It Could Happen Here, which I know is published last year. It's really a compelling read. And you talk in the outset of that book about the impetus for getting into this work and for writing the book. And I was hoping that you could share that story and some of the key messages from the book.
Yeah. So this book, It Could Happen Here, is something that I started working on after the shooting in Pittsburgh because I was seeing so much and was started to write just to kind of work through my thoughts. And then that evolved into a proposal, which then evolved into a deal, and I wrote it. And we published it a little over a year ago on the one-year anniversary of the attack on the Capitol building. We released it on January 6, 2022. And, you know, the book really, in many ways, it's all ADL. I mean, it is essentially like this distillation of 100 plus years of understanding anti-Semitism, fighting hate, you know, trying to show what works, how to deal with these issues, whether you're in, you know, you're in an office, you're at a school, you're on a college campus. The book is really written to share strategies and tactics and tips based on what ADL's learned. But also to your question, Debbie, it's very personal. So I start the book in the place where my journey started. So when I was a junior at Tufts University, I studied abroad. And it was the year 1990 when, you know, the whole European community was transitioning into the European Union and Germany politically reunified. So my grandfather, paternal grandfather, born and raised in East Germany, and then escaped, you know, the Third Reich and came here. And as a refugee, and the stories are all awful. And he really wouldn't talk about it much. You know, my grandfather refused reparations checks, wouldn't return to Germany. Debbie, he was very German in his demeanor and in his outlook, and yet very alienated from his homeland. So very, I think a lot of Holocaust survivors struggle with this type of duality.
Right.
And it was a challenge for him. So when I had the chance, I leapt at the opportunity. And for my December break, I went to that little town in Germany that he was from. And in that little town called Magdeburg, they had a tourism office, which is sort of a very like communist thing. I mean, there was no tourism in East Germany. Nonetheless, I went into this little hut right off the train station. I took the train from Berlin. There were still Soviet soldiers there on the platform. I mean, there was still the Soviet Union at the time. It's not really even that long ago. I went into this office. Wasn't a lot there. There was a young woman there who probably wasn't much older than me, Debbie. And I had bought a German-English dictionary because I don't speak a word of German. And I approached her and I tried to say in terrible, broken German, using the dictionary, that my grandfather was from this town, never came back. I'm here today. I'd like to meet people from the Jewish community, maybe see the synagogue. I don't know what I was thought I was going to find. I had some sort of idealized notion the way one does when you're whatever I was, 19, 20 years old. And the woman really didn't understand what I was saying at all, which I chalked up to my total incomprehension of the German language.
Right.
But so she went to the back. She came back out with an older person, older woman. I don't know how old. In retrospect, I mean, she was probably younger than I am today. I'm 52. This woman may have been, I don't know, in her 40s. She seemed very old to me at the time. And I went through the whole thing again, this whole tortured kind of explanation. And the two women spoke to each other in German. And then the older woman said to me in very broken English, she basically said to me, Debbie, we don't understand. No one has asked these questions. There are no Jews here. What do you want? Like, she
so sobering.
It was so sobering. It was even more than sobering. It was like a big thing of cold water. Again, like it's hard for me to tell you with certainty exactly what I was expecting. But to hear that she just, again, the question just didn't compute. It didn't make, it seemed like it just wasn't, she just didn't understand what I was asking. It wasn't the language issue. It was the illogic of asking for something that didn't exist. And so that really left sort of a hole in me. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, I think it's a hole I didn't fill until I came to ADL for the first time as a professional. I mean, this is an opportunity for me to deal with the ignorance that and the intolerance that catalyzed the Holocaust. This is a chance for me to put what I know to work, not just in terms of protecting the Jews, but all marginalized community. This is a chance for me to help get things right. So I think back to that moment very often, and that's indeed how I opened the book.
When I read that opening part of the book, I actually was thinking about when I went abroad in the spring of 1988, so pretty close in time. And I actually visited the Soviet Union and visited refusnik families and went to the ends of the subway line and visited these families that had, you know, requested that they leave the country and then were thrown out of their jobs and refused to be able to go anywhere. And that's the story that was resonant in me. And it was just really chilling in reading that. So I want to get into more the issue around anti-Semitism and to frame out the issue. I think it'd be helpful to start with some statistics that reflect the representation of Jews in the US and also the incidence of anti-Semitism relative to other hate crimes.
Well, so anti-Semitism is sometimes described as the oldest hatred. I mean, it unfortunately has been a persistent part of the human condition for thousands of years, especially since the death of Christ. And it has mutated over time. So I think one could characterize the early years of anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish hate as directed against Jews, trying to sort of delegitimize them. It's not a real religion. And so, again, in its earliest form, that antipathy was rooted in the Roman Empire's anger that the Jews didn't all acquiesce, early Christianity's anger that the presence of the Jews after the quote-unquote emergence of the Messiah, one could say that he wasn't really the Messiah since the Jews didn't accept him. And then, you know, as the church kind of morphed into the crown and you had these royal families divinely appointed who were ruling countries like Germany and Spain and Portugal, and Italy, and France, and so on, those kings adopted, you know, the anti-Semitism of the church and propounded it. Think about the Spanish Inquisition. But again, mainly based on the idea that the Jews were an evil people because they didn't accept Christ. The Jews were greedy because they were forced into money lending roles. The Jews were manipulating things. It just goes on and on. And then I think anti-Semitism after the Enlightenment, when people started questioning the role of organized religion, post-Catholicism, post-Protestantism, anti-Semitism sort of evolved, Debbie. And then it became more of like delegitimizing the Jews, not as a religion, but as a people. And so there it was, you know, if you recall this sort of pseudoscience of eugenics that really manifested in the Holocaust, where they said the Jews are not part of the human race, they're subhuman. It was once religious-based anti-Semitism, it became racialized anti-Semitism. And then after the Shoah, with 6 million Jews were annihilated across Europe, anti-Semitism was certainly less fashionable, and it sort of changed. The delegitimization wasn't about the Jewish religion or the Jewish people. Now it was the Jewish state. Israel is what's illegitimate. Zionism is what's illegitimate. So you could pretty clearly see a trend line or a through line of delegitimization directed against Jews and their rituals and their state and any manifestation of their ethnic or faith orientation. And that, in many ways, what I would say is that anti-Semitism, unlike other forms of prejudice, say racism, where it can be a bias directed against people because they're seen as inferior, anti-Semitism is kind of a conspiracy theory about how the world works, where you blame the Jews for having too much power, being too greedy, being responsible for the world's ills. ADL just released attitudinal research. I mean, we've been doing sort of sentiment analyses since the 1960s. ADL has been researching anti-Semitism longer than any other organization or institution in America. And what we found in our survey that we released is that in 2022, relative to 2019, that the percent of the population that has deeply held anti-Semitic beliefs, Debbie, has almost doubled. Some 20% of the population holds classic anti-Semitic beliefs.
Wow.
That, again, is almost double what it was 3 years ago. Now, what I would say about that is there's a lot of racism in this society. It's a lot of homophobia in this society, a lot of misogyny in this society. It isn't that one form of hate is worse than the others. They're all bad. I think for Jews, what is complicated about it is, number one, in an environment where systems are failing, where the government can't seem to solve your problems, and there's a deep state or whatever lunacy they say in some quarters, when the markets can't solve your problems, jobs are disappearing and the banks are doing things that are wrong, and people are looking for someone, when the solutions can't be found and the problems are complicated, people have a tendency to try to simplify to try to simplify the answers by finding scapegoats. And the Jews have almost always served as that scapegoat, whether it's in Europe, I didn't even mention the Middle East, or other parts of the world. The Jews have been a convenient scapegoat for millennia. And so that's one thing I think that makes anti-Semitism very different. Because as a conspiracy theory, it adapts, Debbie, and it mutates relative to the circumstance. So for some, Jews are communists. For others, Jews are capitalists. For some, Jews are too powerful. For others, Jews don't have any power. For sometimes, it's Jews are too out in front. For sometimes, it's Jews are too hidden. Like, this conspiracy theory is such a shape-shifting phenomenon that makes it somewhat unique and deeply pernicious.
And I want to pick up on the use of the word complicated, because that is part of the challenge around anti-Semitism. I've been advocating for women's rights for more than 20 years, and a lot of that work comes under the diversity umbrella. And I've also been outspoken as an ally to other disenfranchised groups. Mm-hmm. What is tricky to me in articulating anti-Semitism, and I'm hoping you can shed some light on this, is given the minority status of Jews, we're only 2.4% of the US population, and the historic persecution of Jews that you just outlined. Jews fit squarely under this diversity umbrella, yet some would argue that due to our significant representation in certain industries or circles of power, that Jews don't deserve the same protection or allyship as other underrepresented groups. And I'm just wondering what your response would be to that.
Well, it's interesting. This is one of the claims that the Jews are overrepresented in industries. But of course, if you think about it, you know, Jews were forced into finance because the majoritarian population wouldn't allow Jews to own land or be in other trades. So Jews went into sales and they went into finance, trades for which you didn't need assets. Now, finance is such a big part of our economy. Jews are well represented in the finance industry. And people blame the Jews for that. Another example would be the entertainment industry, like motion pictures, television. There was a group of Jews who literally couldn't find work in the East Coast, who went at the turn of the 20th century out to California and helped to create the industry from scratch. And today, you know, Jews are blamed as being overrepresented in Hollywood, even though they had to invent the industry themselves in the first place. So it is a sign of the noxious nature of anti-Semitism, Debbie, that our success is used against us. Our achievements somehow are used to undermine us. And that folks wanna, to be frank, like erase that success. We saw this with the opening of the Motion Picture Museum in Los Angeles last year. I went to the opening, or like a pre-opening event, and I walked the whole facility, and I turned to my colleague I was with and I said to him, "Where are the Jews?" Because there was no meaningful representation whatsoever about the Jewish role in helping to create Hollywood. So does that mean the Jews control Hollywood? Certainly not, for God's sakes. Are they control finance? Certainly not. They don't control, Jews can barely control, you know, their own synagogues, you know, the wards are always fighting with each other and whatnot. There is no organized plot. There is no conspiracy. It doesn't work that way. But to your point, because Jews have been blessed to have some success, now many people say, well, you're not really a besieged minority. Oftentimes the Jews are seen as, well, you're white and you're privileged. But of course, you know, look, the Jewish community is a multi-ethnic, multi-racial community to begin with. There are many Jews of color who identify as African-American or Latino or indigenous or Asian-American. There are Mizrahi Jews, you know, from the Middle East who certainly don't present as white or Caucasian per se. So I think people don't often understand the diversity within the Jewish community, but then to see Jews relegated, and what's interesting about that is the Jews will never be white for right-wing extremists. They see us as something else. And we are uber white for kind of very left-wing radicals who see us as somehow the symbol of power. I mean, the bottom line is that Jews get caught in the middle. So I think these issues of race and religion and gender and whatnot, these are tough things to grapple with. I think much of our society is trying to do so, and that's an admirable effort. But, you know, when Jews get left behind, I think it's a problem. The way that I characterize it, Debbie, you could almost segment anti-Semitism into two halves. There is abrasive anti-Semitism. Abrasive anti-Semitism is the in-your-face, the threats, the vandalism, the violence. And by the way, the data on that is stunning. I mentioned the almost doubling of attitudes. We've had a nearly tripling of anti-Semitic incidents in recent years in America. Last year was the highest year ADL's ever tracked. Acts of harassment, vandalism, and violence directed against Jews, 2,717. That is abrasive anti-Semitism. And whether it's masquerading as anti-Zionism or this, that, hatred against Jews needs to be called out for what it is. But in addition to abrasive anti-Semitism, Debbie, there's also what I would characterize as erasive anti-Semitism. The effort to not include Jews when we memorialize the quest for civil rights, to eliminate Jews when we talk about the push for women's rights, as you were alluding to before. The people who say that Jews or the Jewish state are pinkwashing when they lift up the rights for LGBTQ people. I mean, that is a kind of erasive anti-Semitism, which might not augur the kind of violence that murdered people in Pittsburgh, in Poway, in Charlottesville, in Muncie, in Jersey City, the kidnapping that happened in Colleyville a year ago, the hostage crisis. But erasive anti-Semitism, whether it's on a college campus or a workplace environment or in the history books, it is equally pernicious and deeply problematic.
There's so many threads that I want to pick up on there, and I want to just stick with this abrasive notion for a moment. And we see with stereotyping and messages of hate through social media in particular are, as you said, these pernicious ways that anti-Semitism is spread and normalized. And the most recent extreme example was with Kanye West. But there's also been other criticism from Kyrie Irving in his recent sharing of a movie denying the Holocaust, or some have objected to Dave Chappelle's SNL monologue about the Jews. Is there value in engaging in some of these conversations and not others? And how do you draw the line and avoid a cancel culture that will ultimately become more damaging?
Well, look, first and foremost, again, just to make sure we contextualize the question with the moment we're in, something is going on that is very, very real. Attitudes, which were flat for almost a decade, you know, are going up in the wrong direction. Incidents, which had been declining for like 15 years, have soared in the last five. Jewish people, you'll read kind of third-party surveys, Jewish people feel anxious with good reason. I mean, you see it, I would say that anti-Semitism hasn't just been normalized in our culture, Debbie, it's been popularized by athletes and entertainers and elected officials and whatnot. Now, all that being said, in ADL, we do not believe, and I personally don't believe in cancel culture. I believe in council culture.
I like that term again. Explain what you mean by council culture.
Council culture means when someone does wrong, you shouldn't eject them. You need to embrace them. All of us make mistakes. In the Jewish faith, you know, on Yom Kippur every year, the Day of Atonement, we repent. We do the Al Chet prayer to repent for the sins that we've committed over the course of the year. And in Judaism, we have this concept called teshuvah. And teshuvah is about repentance. And the concept is that when someone sincerely repents, you are obligated to forgive them. I think that is the highest aspiration to which one can reach, the grace required to forgive the sinner, even if someone has sinned against you. So council culture for me means when this guy who was outed as a white supremacist was found out and he was brought to my attention, I didn't, you know, reject him. I welcomed him and we now have a very close friendship. And whether it's Whoopi Goldberg or Kyrie Irving or whatever, like, I think it's incumbent upon us, again, to embrace the person who errs not to excommunicate them. Now, but to your question, there are some who don't want to repent, or whose act of apology is clearly vacuous, is clearly hollow. Kanye West, Mel Gibson, plenty of others who have said horrible things and then been incredibly inauthentic about it. Like, I don't want anything to do with them. I don't want their apology. I don't want their money. I don't want their time. It's not easy to do that. And I think this is much more art than science, Debbie. But I think as the head of the ADL, it is my job to be willing to work with even people that I don't like, even people with whom I might disagree, as long as they're willing to do the work. That's what you need to see.
And you've talked about the context and the environment we're in now, and that rise in anti-Semitism on college campuses is terrifying. There was a December Wall Street Journal piece that cited the ADL's research and the study finding that hostility, including vandalism, threats, and slurs toward Jewish students on college campuses has increased more than threefold since 2014. And the article also talked about schools where students are attempting to prevent or remove Jewish classmates from serving in student government because of their support of Israel. What's your advice for college administrators? What can they do to enable everyone on college campuses to feel safe and comfortable communicating their views respectfully?
So I have a couple thoughts on that. While we have not done an exhaustive survey, our anecdotal observations suggest that the vast majority of DEI, or diversity, equity, inclusion programs in America, whether they're in a workplace DEI, campus DEI, and others, they will address issues of race, sometimes gender, sometimes sexual orientation. They almost never address anti-Semitism. Again, I haven't done the definitive survey of the Fortune 500, but I can tell you that time and again, it's a kind of erase of anti-Semitism. And we can try to kind of peel back the layers as to why that is, but it's an issue. So anti-Semitism just is dismissed or just denied or diminished in many of these environments. In particular, college campuses, where so often the concerns of Jewish students are equated with some kind of political speech, as if, oh, it's just people protesting because they're upset with Israel. But the level of vitriol, Debbie, directed at Hillels is mind-boggling. It is okay to criticize policies of the state of Israel. I do. It is okay to criticize practices of the Israeli government. I do. But there's something deeply different and morally offensive and flat out wrong when people dehumanize Israelis, when they demonize the Jewish state, when they hold the country to double standards. Like, you can have strong feelings, Debbie, about China and the policies of Beijing against the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, the protesters for democracy in Hong Kong, COVID-19, I could go on, the surveillance state, but no one would say, therefore it's okay to harass Asian American people in this country. You can have very strong feelings about Saudi, right? Or about some other Muslim countries that can pretend to be dictatorial, women don't have full rights. But no one would say, therefore, it's okay to harass Muslims in this country. And by the same token, it is not okay to harass, to berate, to belittle, to bully Jews in this country. Now, for college administrators, what do we need them to do? Number one, there should be anti-Semitism, including anti-Zionism, should be part of every DEI training in America. So college students learn to distinguish between legitimate, valid criticism and illegitimate venomous hate. That's number one. Number two, we need our leaders to lead, and the deans of students or the college presidents themselves should show a little bit of courage and appreciate that their Jewish students need the same protection that their other kids do. Now, the last thing I'll say about this is there's a law or a body of law called Title VI, which you may be familiar with, which prevents discrimination against people based on race or religion or national origin. One of the things that we're trying to do at ADL is to make sure that Jewish kids are protected by Title VI. Because people say, whoa, they're not attacking you because of your Jewish religion. They're attacking you because of the Jewish state and its policies. But it's one and the same, Debbie. And the inability of people to see that has created this huge loophole that these detractors, these sort of bigots have used, again, as a cudgel to bludgeon Jewish students for far too long.
You talk in the book about how anti-Zionism, which is defined as the opposition to the establishment or support of the state of Israel, is synonymous with anti-Semitism. And many disagree with this premise. Can you break that down for us a little bit more? Because I think it's important how you elucidate. It is legitimate to criticize Israeli politics, let's say, and that's a different issue than being anti-Zionist.
I mean, look, it is entirely legitimate to criticize policy of the state of Israel. It's entirely legitimate to criticize policy of the country of America or the Republic of France and so on. But we need to understand what Zionism is. Zionism is the idea that Jewish people have the right to self-determination in their homeland. That Jews have the right to self-determination in their homeland. Their homeland is Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, from which Jews were exiled, thrown out, that 2,000 years ago. Zionism isn't new. It's been around for 2,000 years. Now, it's taken more of a political sheen in the last 100 plus years with the modern effort to create an actual nation state in that land and to founding of the State of Israel in 1948. Look, the idea that Jews have the right to self-determination is no different than the idea that, like, we as Americans have the right to self-determination, or indigenous people do, and so on and so forth. When you hold Jews to a different standard than everyone else, when you would deny them the same basic right you would afford to everyone else, that's the definition, that's emblematic of prejudice, and I would say anti-Semitism, prejudice against Jews. That's what anti-Semitism is. Now, it is fair to say that if you're someone who does not believe in any form of nationalism, if you believe in no boundaries, no borders, if you believe that no country really has a right to exist, okay, then maybe your criticism of Zionism is grounded in some deeper worldview. But unless you hold that fact to be true for every country on the planet, when you only hold out the state of Israel for particular, you know, derision, that kind of obsession, Debbie, anti-Semitism. So what I would say in short is that even though there are people who may say they oppose Zionism or the Zionist state and might not understand what it means, that doesn't matter. Because the way it manifests, you have a protest against an anti-Zionist demonstration, then there are signs that say Israel equals Nazism. Okay, that's anti-Semitic. It is anti-Semitic to reduce the Jewish people to those who exterminated us. It is barbaric and a grotesque claim to make. Or we see it on college campuses, Debbie, there'll be an anti-Zionist protest, and then suddenly there are swastikas on the fraternity. That is anti-Semitic. Or we see it, Debbie, where there are calls to shut down Hillels on college campuses. It's a cultural organization that, you know, is there to do Havdalah services, not hand-to-hand combat. That's anti-Semitic. Unless you're calling to shut down every other religious and cultural institution on campus. So it is the double standards, it is the demonization, it is the derision, that whether or not it's the intention, that is almost inevitably the outcome of anti-Zionism, and that's why it's so problematic.
It's also about misinformation. It is this notion, and the majority of Jews like you and like me feel that a two-state solution is the answer. So it's not Jewish rights at the expense of everybody else's, it's in addition to everyone else's. And I think that's really what's underscoring what you're talking about, nationalism across the board in different countries.
Of course. I mean, and I'll say more than that. Of course, Zionism accommodates for that. Zionism doesn't say the right of Jewish self-determination, but nobody else. Like, doesn't say, that's not the idea, number one. And number two, even if it didn't say that, like, even if I didn't believe, I am a ferocious advocate for a two-state solution. I think you can only have safety and security for Jews in Israel when you can also have dignity and equality for the Palestinians in a state of their own. That might not seem practical to some, that might be out of fashion to say in some segments of society, but I believe it to be true. But even if I didn't, my political opinions should have no bearing on the ability of people to target and victimize me because of my ethnicity. And again, I come back to the example of China. Like you, I mean, the Chinese Communist Party does a lot of things that I don't like, but that does not give me or anyone license to target and victimize Asian American people. Forget it. No way.
Some Jews, including me, have been reticent to speak out about anti-Semitism, given the success Jews have had in many fields and the increasing public criticism of Israel. Yet I'm really horrified by the disproportionate rise of anti-Semitism. I'm personally ashamed that I haven't been more vocal, and that's part of the impetus for this interview now. Whether we are represented well in certain industries or not, that doesn't mean that it's appropriate for us to go to temple in the presence of armed guards. There's another side of this story that needs to be told. And my question to you is, what advice do you have for people who haven't been as outspoken to have the courage and the confidence to become more outspoken?
Well, first of all, don't blame yourself. I totally don't agree with that. I mean, I think as Jews, look, there are only 15 million Jews on the planet Earth, a planet of 9 billion people. We are an incredibly small minority, literally. Like you said, less than 2.5 the US population. I even think it's less than that. I say this, Debbie, because one of the things that Jews learned living for thousands of years in exile as a beleaguered minority in predominantly Christian or Muslim countries is keep your head down, don't make noise, don't draw attention to yourself. Because when you do, it typically ends up with you being persecuted in some way. So it's kind of like it's almost like an inherited, you know, trait. It's like an instinctual behavior. Jews learn, keep your mouth shut. We just do. And whether or not people appreciate that, I think Jews learned a long time ago to turn the other cheek. Because we were powerless for thousands of years and subject to the whims and caprice of others. Now, where are we today? Here and now, we have some degree of power. We shouldn't be afraid to exercise it. Not power like the extremists suggest, not power like the anti-Semites purport, but like we've been able to be successful in many different industries. We can now live wherever we want in the United States. We can get healthcare, medical treatment wherever we want in the United States. We can attend wherever university we want. We never used to have that kind of privilege. So it's up to us to relearn or to unlearn what it means to be reticent and to feel sufficiently confident to be bold. So Debbie, there's no one way to do it, but we need to remind ourselves. And it's why I wrote the book, because it could happen here. And the only way that we stop it from happening here is to roll up our sleeves and realize that democracy and society, it's a contact sport, not a spectator sport that you can watch, you know, from back there in the cheap seats. You got to get on the field. You got to be ready to play. So I think that's true for all of us as a community. Frankly, it's true for people of good faith across the country.
What have I missed or gotten wrong, or what do you want to highlight that we didn't have a chance to cover as we wrap up our conversation?
The other thing I think we should say is if we try to understand why we're in this moment, definitely the anti-Semitism made is up because of extremists being emboldened. I think it's also up because of the obsession with identity politics, which is so reductive and like shrinks people into their most, you know, their smallest form, rather than appreciating the breadth of our identities. And the third thing, though, I think is real, is social media. It's like social media is a super spreader of anti-Semitism and hate. So we've got work to do to make sure that, again, DEI programs cover anti-Semitism, to make sure that leaders lead and demonstrate responsibility, that people in public life call out prejudice when it happens, and to make sure that the companies and the laws that govern them ensure that there's safety for all users, you know, including Jews and other minorities in these online spaces.
What I would add to that is to storytell. You do that beautifully in the book. And telling personal stories and bringing anecdotes to life and reaching across the aisle and having personal, deep relationships with people who are not consistent with your beliefs initially, but you can find common ground and have relationships. That personal touch I see as a really important asset to this conversation. And I think it's something that can really help bridge some gaps for people.
Perfect.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, for today's conversation and for your inspirational work, and to the ADL team for facilitating today's conversation. I want to encourage our listeners to visit the Anti-Defamation League website at adl.org and to learn about their amazing work and benefit from their tremendous resources. I also hope our listeners pick up a copy of your book, Jonathan. It Could Happen Here. Book.org is where you can find it. It's a really thoughtful and powerful read. So thanks again and wishing you continued success.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I want to thank our incredible podcast team, producer David Seth Cohn and Precision Pictures LTD, and of course, the amazing Renee Green. If you're enjoying Inspiration Loves Company, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, rate and review us, and tell your family, friends, and colleagues. Oh, and one more thing. Be sure to join us next time.